This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Israel and Israeli settlers are committing the crime of pillage in the Dead Sea, according to a new report. We'll have an interview with Nancy Krikorian of Code Pink and the Stolen Beauty Campaign targeting Ahava cosmetics, which are made in an Israeli settlement colony in the West Bank, with materials taken from the Dead Sea.
Nordstrom is actually party to a war crime by selling products that are made with pillaged Palestinian natural resources.
Also, Egypt reopens the border crossing with Gaza for now. A pro-Israel platform amendment is forced through at the Democratic National Convention despite failing to achieve a two-thirds majority vote in what Ali Abunima says is a, quote, neat summary of how U.S. elites make decisions when it comes to Israel.
Hearing none, the matter requires a two-thirds vote in the affirmative. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no. In the opinion of the... Let me do that again.
Civil rights advocates condemn the California Assembly's passage of a resolution on so-called anti-Semitism on college campuses, seen as a thinly disguised attempt to curb Palestine solidarity activism at U.S. universities. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including the cancellation of a show by a popular Lebanese band scheduled to open for the Red Hot Chili Peppers in Beirut, in protest of the Chili Peppers' commitment to play in Tel Aviv, and more. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin in the occupied West Bank. Writing for Interpress Service and published on the Electronic Intifada this week, Gillian Kessler-Damour reported that the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq has released a report saying that by mining natural resources from the West Bank for its own economic purposes, Israel is committing the war crime of pillage in the Dead Sea area. In the report, Al-Haq states, quote, Israel is openly in violation of its obligations as an occupying power because it is encouraging and facilitating the exploitation of Palestinian natural resources and actively assisting their pillaging by private actors. Reporter Gillian Kessler-Damour adds, quote, criminal responsibility for pillage does not only extend to the state of Israel, but can also be applied to individuals, including Israeli settlers, who benefit from the extraction of resources from the Dead Sea. The Al-Haq report adds, quote, although settlers and companies involved in the exploitation of the natural resources of the Dead Sea are mainly encouraged to do so by the State of Israel, they cannot ignore that such resources are considered Palestinian under international law. This should be sufficient to substantiate the mental element of the crime of pillage, thus allowing for some Israeli settlers to be considered as the direct perpetrators of that crime, end quote. That was part of a report by Al-Haq. Kessler-Damour writes, quote, Israel has maintained that numerous covenants of international humanitarian law do not apply to the occupied West Bank and Gaza, since those areas are not under Israel's jurisdiction. Recently, an Israeli government-appointed committee, known as the Levy Committee, also ruled that Israel is not an occupying power and that, therefore, Israeli settlements in the West Bank are legal. Nonetheless, many international jurists have maintained that Israel is violating basic principles of international law in its occupation of Palestinian land and exploitation of Palestinian resources. Article 47 of the Hague Convention, which outlines war crimes under international humanitarian law, states that, quote, pillage is formally forbidden. Activists have launched a worldwide boycott campaign against Israeli products that are manufactured in the occupied West Bank and are inaccurately labeled as made in Israel. That was an excerpt of a full report on this issue by Gillian Kessler-Damour. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. Joining us to talk about the ongoing pillage of natural resources by Israel and Israeli settlement industries is Nancy Krikorian of Code Pink and the Stolen Beauty Campaign, which has been actively organizing against Ahava beauty products, which are made from resources pillaged from the Dead Sea and fabricated in an illegal settlement colony in the West Bank. Nancy Krikorian joins us from New York. Nancy, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. Great to talk with you.
So first off, what's the significance of this report by Al-Haq that states that in no uncertain terms, Israel and Israeli settlements are committing the crime of pillage in the West Bank, notably in the Dead Sea area?
Well, what's significant is that that Al-Haq is a leading Palestinian human rights organization, and that they, you know, using documentation that we were able to get through our partners at Who Profits from the Occupation, which is a project of the Israeli Coalition of Women for Peace, they were able to, you know, use this documentation showing that Ahava actually was given license to excavate mud on the shores of the occupied shores of the Dead Sea by the Israeli Civil Administration. They were able to show that this, you know, legally is pillage, you know, look under the Geneva Convention, and I believe it's also called plunder under the Hague Convention. So it's great to have, you know, this legal claim made in a very public way by a Palestinian human rights organization. Because in the meantime, of course, Ahava, we've been dealing with them since, I don't know, June of 2009, and they continue to claim that what they do is completely legal, as the Israeli government claims that this excavation, you know, the quarrying and excavation that, that the Israeli companies have going on in the West Bank is also legal. But the only ones who think it are is legal, you know, think that's legal, is the Israeli government, and the rest of the world basically thinks it's occupation profiteering, is what we call it.
We'll talk a little bit more about the BDS campaigns by Stolen Beauty and others that are targeting Ahava, and if you could assess the successes of these campaigns around the world.
Yeah, it's been really great. You know, when we started our campaign in, as I said, June of 2009, and before we had started, there were activists in London who, during the Operation Cast Lead attack on Gaza, had blockaded the flagship Covent Garden store of Ahava in London. And this was part of, you know, our inspiration. And so I would say from the beginning, this has really been a coalition campaign where we work with partners in England, France, South Africa, Czech Republic, all Japan, all over the place. And it's everyone is using the tools that they have at their disposal, given what the status of the BDS movement in the country they're in is, and also given what kind of legal challenges are available to be made. So, for example, the Open Shuhada Street group in South Africa was able to get the South African Minister for Trade to actually change the labeling rules in South Africa. So now Ahava, which was mentioned by name, you know, when this announcement was made about the new labeling, and all Israeli settlement goods will now be labeled, it will say, product of Israeli occupied territories. So it's, and they've been saying that it's about truth in labeling and truth in advertising so that consumers can make an informed choice, which is great. And that there's a push to do that in the EU as well, either to have this kind of more accurate labeling of settlement goods saying where they're coming from, or to, right now there's some discussion even of banning them in the EU. So that's fantastic.
Nancy Krikorian, if you could kind of draw us a picture of the process that goes into making Ahava Cosmetics. You know, take us through this structure of occupation profiteering that's going on there.
Yes, well, the sort of company profile is, it's a, you know, privately held company, and some percentage, I don't have the number right in front of me, I think it's like 44% or something of the company is owned by two illegal settlements, one of them, which is Mitzpah Shelem, which is where the factory and visitor center are located, and the other one is Kalia, which is also on the shores of the Dead Sea, and it's from near Kalia that the mud is pillaged. And these two settlements, because they are co-owners of the company, are therefore subsidized by the company's profits. So it's a, you know, settlement. So the settlements themselves are being directly subsidized by Ahava's products. They have this, their main factory and their visitor center, as I said, is in the occupied West Bank, and they label their products as product of Israel, and it's gotten trickier and trickier to actually find out where the goods actually come from. You have to practically use a magnifying glass at this point, and the only way you can tell that it's coming from this illegal settlement of Mitzvah Shelem is by looking at the postal code, and they give you the actual postal code of that illegal settlement. But other than that, there's no, you know, there would be no way for a consumer to know actually what they were purchasing, where it was coming from.
And that's where the activism comes in. Can you talk about the campaigns now, especially you're kicking off a campaign against Nordstrom department stores?
Yes, I would say, you know, we're having a bit of a tougher time in the States than they say are in South Africa or in the European Union or even in Japan, partly because U.S. labeling law is so lax. So we haven't, and also because our organized opposition here in the States is sort of more powerful, I would say, than what people have to face, say, in South Africa or in England or in France. So we have been trying to go after these big chains, but we have not that much leverage. We feel like with Nordstrom, however, that there, we do have some leverage in that we've had people, supporters of our campaign, have had back and forth emails with Blake Nordstrom, who's the CEO, and he basically said that he had had his attorneys look at the relevant law and talk with the AHVA attorneys and so on, da, da, da. But now that we have this finding from Al-Haq, we feel like we have more leverage with them, because also Nordstrom, which, you know, its motto is leave it better than you found it, and has this very strong social responsibility credo for the company. And it says things like, we work hard, you know, this is from their credo, we also work hard to ensure that the goods we sell in our stores are made in compliance with applicable laws. Well, perhaps they're made in compliance with very lax U.S. Labeling laws, but they are not made in compliance with international law. And one of our angles is also trying to push on Calvert, which is a socially responsible investing company, and they say that Nordstrom is socially responsible, and we're going to be making the argument, which we have, but we're going to be doing it more vocally, more publicly, that Calvert shouldn't say that Nordstrom is socially responsible when Nordstrom is actually party to a war crime by selling products that are made with pillaged Palestinian natural resources.
Finally, Nancy Krikorian of Stolen Beauty and Code Pink. How can people get involved and know more about these boycott campaigns?
Yeah, I would say for our campaign, we have a website that we use as a central hub for all the organizing that's going around the world on this right now, and that's www.stolenbeauty.org. And then you can get in, also involved via the BDS movement, which is the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and their website is www.bdsmovement.net.
Great. Nancy Krikorian, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. That was Nancy Krikorian of Code Pink and the Stolen Beauty Campaign speaking to us from New York City. For much more on the story, visit our BDS section at electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. In another report from Interpress Service, Eva Bartlett reported from southern Gaza this week that Egypt has, for now, reopened the border crossing at Rafah, easing travel for Palestinians for whom the Rafah crossing is their only exit point to the outside world, as Israel continues to seal the rest of the boundaries. Egyptian authorities had closed the Rafah crossing after an attack on Egyptian soldiers last month in the Sinai Peninsula. Palestinians were immediately blamed for the attack, although no evidence has come to light yet that would identify the perpetrators. Although the border was opened this week, Bartlett reported that Palestinians in Gaza are cautiously optimistic about their freedom of movement, since over the last 12 years, the border has remained opened or closed at the whim of either Israeli or Egyptian decisions. Bartlett wrote, quote, "With no clear border procedure yet defined by Egyptian authorities, Palestinians in Gaza are wondering whether the easing of restrictions on border crossings introduced following Mohamed Morsi's election as Egypt's president will continue, or whether the situation will revert back to the days of Hosni Mubarak's dictatorship when the crossing was often closed." She added, quote, "After Hamas was democratically elected in 2006, and in tandem with implementation of the Israeli-led total siege of Gaza, the Rafah border crossing procedures became as trying as when Israel physically and militarily occupied the Gaza Strip." The Israeli human rights group Gisha has reported that from June 2007 to March 2009, the Rafah crossing was closed permanently, except for random and limited openings by Egypt, which meet only 3% of the needs of residents of the Gaza Strip to enter and leave. Bartlett's report stated that, quote, in 2000, Israel closed Gaza's sole airport. Israeli bombings in 2001 destroyed it. Under international law, Palestinians, like any people, have the right to leave and enter their country, a basic right which the parties who exert control over Rafah crossing are obligated to respect and safeguard, Gisha has noted. That was an excerpt of a full report by Eva Bartlett, reporting from the Rafah crossing in southern Gaza. For much more on the story, visit electronicintifada.net. We now go to news from the Democratic National Convention this week in Charlotte, North Carolina. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima wrote that, quote, an extraordinary thing happened at the Democratic National Convention on Wednesday. The official party platform for 2012 left out a reference that, quote, Jerusalem is and will remain the capital of Israel, end quote, that was in the 2008 version. Abu Nima added, quote, under pressure from the Israeli lobby and the Republicans, the Democratic leadership hastily moved to shove it back in on a voice vote that required a two-thirds majority. But to the stunned surprise of Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who is chairing the convention, the no votes seem to be louder, as video documentation shows. Abu Nima adds in his blog post, quote, shocked, Villaraigosa held the vote a second time and then a third time. Each time it seemed the no's had it. Nonetheless, Villaraigosa declared that it had passed anyway. Loud booing could be heard. It's an astonishing spectacle. We now go to audio from that vote.
Hearing none, the matter requires a two-thirds vote in the affirmative. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
No.
In the opinion of the... Let me do that again. All of those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no. I guess.
You've got to rule, and then you've got to let them do what they're going to do. Rule.
I'll do that one more time. All those delegates in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those delegates opposed say no.
No.
In the opinion of the chair, two-thirds have voted in the affirmative. The motion is adopted. And the platform has been amended as shown on the screen. Thank you very much. Thank you.
A longer excerpt of Ali Abu Nima's blog post follows. Quote, apparently Obama himself intervened, as the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reports, late Tuesday afternoon after Republicans launched a full-force offensive criticizing the omission, the Democrats reversed course. Robert Wexler, a member of the platform draft committee and a chief Jewish surrogate for the Obama campaign, credited President Obama for the change. Quote, they are returning the language to the 2008 situation, Wexler told JTA late Tuesday. The president directly intervened to make sure this amendment happened. Abu Nima adds, but it seems a ploy by Obama to pander to the Israel lobby has badly backfired. Gleeful Republicans are already circulating the video and spinning it as Democrats booing Israel. Abu Nima adds, quote, I personally am uninterested in the GOP versus Democratic aspect. I consider both parties indistinguishable on Israel and so many other issues. They are part of the same ruling establishment. But ramming through AIPAC's desires, despite an apparent no vote, was a neat summary of how U.S. elites make decisions when it comes to Israel. Both parties are in a bidding war to appease Israel's most extreme supporters at home and abroad. If this means riding roughshod over their own members, the American public, world opinion, international law, and the basic rights of the Palestinian people, then so be it. Finally, Abu Nima writes on his blog, quote, for those committed to justice in Palestine, Wednesday's events are a reminder that the road to justice does not go through the GOP, the RNC, or the DNC. But for us in the United States, it goes through BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, against an Israeli apartheid regime that has the full backing of U.S. political elites. Jerusalem, after all, and all of Palestine are not Barack Obama's or Mitt Romney's to auction off to the highest bidder. For the full blog post on this story, including the video clip of the vote, visit Ali's blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. In the wake of the University of California issuing a campus climate report on Jewish students several months ago, recommending what many see as putting restrictions on Palestine solidarity activism on campuses across the state in the supposed effort of combating, quote, anti-Semitism, the California State Assembly passed a resolution on August 28th that many civil and human rights advocates say is a similar effort to curb activism and free speech by students and faculty. As I reported for the Electronic Intifada, the resolution, which was passed without debate and without input from community groups, quote, calls upon institutions to increase their efforts to swiftly and unequivocally condemn acts of anti-Semitism on their campuses and to utilize existing resources, such as the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights' working definition of anti-Semitism, to help guide campus discussion about and promote, as appropriate, educational programs for combating anti-Semitism on their campuses, end quote. H.R. 35 is a non-binding resolution and has no policy mandate, but a careful reading of the vocabulary and wording has direct similarities to accusations made by Zionist groups and students against Palestine solidarity activism and Muslim student groups on campuses in California. The resolution calls for public institutions, for example, to condemn, quote, student and faculty-sponsored boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns against Israel that are a means of demonizing Israel and seek to harm the Jewish state, end quote. As I reported last month, many Zionist and Israel lobby organizations are using and exploiting the term anti-Semitism to directly suppress criticism of Israeli policy and Palestine solidarity activism, including boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns on campus. However, even though this non-binding resolution has no policy mandate, it has provoked condemnation by human rights and civil rights groups across the state. The Council on American Islamic Relations stated that, quote, along with 9 community, legal, and student organizations, CARE sent a letter to lawmakers about House Resolution 35 because it stifles robust political debate on university campuses. The letter urges lawmakers to reconsider the issue when they reconvene in January. Additionally, in a press release, Jewish Voice for Peace stated that its members are, quote, appalled that the California State Assembly passed a resolution which was presented as a broad condemnation of anti-Semitism on UC campuses, but which goes far beyond that in supporting putting limits on the free speech of students, faculty, and community members who criticize Israeli policies. For much more on this story, visit my blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada reported on Tuesday that Lebanese band Mashru Leila tweeted, quote, we will not be opening for the Red Hot Chili Peppers on September 6th in Beirut. Ali Abu Nima wrote that, quote, this decision, also announced on their Facebook page, follows mounting calls on the group to cancel after Red Hot Chili Peppers rejected calls from the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to cancel a September 10th show in Tel Aviv. As early as last spring, petitions and appeals to the Red Hot Chili Peppers to cancel began to circulate. However, the Red Hot Chili Peppers rejected them and issued a brief video on June 28th, which reaffirmed their, quote, joy, pleasure, and excitement at playing in Tel Aviv and their, quote, great love for Israel. Quote, come one, come all, urged Chili Peppers band member Anthony Kiedis in a video. Abu Nima added, quote, but this is exactly the point of the BDS call. Palestinians living under Israel's apartheid-like restrictions are not free to attend concerts and face innumerable obstacles as dramatized in a brief video linked on this blog post, made to illustrate the near impossibility for millions of Palestinians to attend a recent Madonna concert in Tel Aviv. Notably, the Red Hot Chili Peppers concert will be held in Hayarkon Park, the site of the ethnically cleansed Palestinian village of Jerisha. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, or PACB, issued an additional appeal to the group to change its mind and learn from the example of how cultural boycott had helped hasten the end of apartheid in South Africa. That was an excerpt of Ali Abu Nima's blog post on this story. For more, visit his blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. In other news, the Electronic Intifada's blogger Gabriel Scavone reported that an Israeli settler leader is lamenting the growing impact of the BDS movement. Scavone wrote this week, quote, a growing trend in multinational factories pulling out of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank has settler leaders aggrieved, according to a report by Israel National News, a leading settler media outlet. Several multinational companies in recent months have packed up and left the Barkan Industrial Park near the Ariel settlement in the northern West Bank. In an ironic twist, multinationals that have bought out Israeli companies with facilities in Barkan have moved them out of the occupied territories. Scivone adds that, quote, according to the report, one company's move in particular flustered settler leader Ron Nachman, mayor of the Ariel settlement in the northern occupied West Bank. After European groups organized a boycott of its products, Anglo-Dutch transnational consumer goods manufacturer Unilever removed the bagel and bagel pretzel and cracker factory that it owns and moved it within the pre-June 1967 boundaries. The settler mayor said he authorized the establishment of the factory in Ariel's Barkan industrial zone over 20 years ago, praising it as a, quote, wonderful business. And now, quote, all of a sudden Unilever buys it up and because of politics moves it out of the territories. Perhaps feeling personally sidelined by the politics of the day, Nachman failed to attend this week's inauguration of his wonderful business's new location. That was an excerpt of a blog post by Gabriel Scivone. For more on the story and other important news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our arts and culture section for important and insightful book reviews and our regular Month in Pictures feature. Also, don't miss the latest in a series of reports by Amina Salim on the BBC's lies and omissions in reporting on Palestine, including how it presented distortions in the coverage of the Rachel Corrie verdict last week. Rami Al-Maghari's diary entry on playing the Palestinian waiting game in Cairo. Asa Winstanley reports on the fabrications of a BBC journalist and filmmaker called a fraud this week by the South African government media director, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.